This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration? I didn't mean to do that. Please, continue.
Okay. It's easy for Samuel L. Jackson to capture your attention. It's not just the gun that gets you. It's his charisma. We just heard a clip from Pulp Fiction. He also starred in Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown. Jackson has made big-budget action films like Star Wars Episode I and Die Hard with a Vengeance, as well as low-budget independent films like Hard Eight and Eve's Bayou. He starred with Kevin Spacey in the cop thriller The Negotiator and with Nicolas Cage in the comedy Amos and Andrew. Jackson appeared in several Spike Lee movies, including Jungle Fever, for which he was given a special award at the Cannes Film Festival. Now he's starring in Shaft as a cop who is the nephew of the private eye portrayed by Richard Roundtree in the original 1971 film. Jackson Shaft is investigating the case of a young African-American man who was murdered outside a bar. Here's Shaft, just after the murder, questioning the suspect, played by Christian Bale.
How'd you get that blood on yourself?
Blood?
I'm going to ask you again. If you give me attitude this time, I'm going to drag you out of here by your hair. How did you get that blood on yourself?
It was late. He started it. And I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I was razzing the guy. He couldn't take a joke.
Oh, so you cracked his head open. Yeah, I can dig it.
I'd fall him out to apologize. Next thing I know, he's coming at me with a silver bat. I was defending myself.
Anybody see?
No, officer. It's just me and him out there. You know who my father is?
No. Do you? Take him out.
Let's go.
A couple of writers worked on the script for Shaft, including Richard Price and Shane Salerno. I asked Samuel Jackson about the different versions of the screenplay.
Well, in one version, John Shaft stayed on the police force. In one version, he ended up going back on the police force. In another version, Richard's character, John Shaft, was a lot more proactive in the resolution of the story. There were different kinds of villains in the story. There were more aggressive moves done by the white character as he came uptown into my particular neighborhood and kind of harassed me as well as me harassing him. There were far-fetched versions and outrageous things going on in the different versions that just, you know, were cartoonish to me.
Mm-hmm. So are there things that you asked to be changed or that you...
Well, yeah, I asked for him to get off the police force specifically.
To get off the police force?
Yeah. My character is a bit volatile and I guess, you know, borderline, you know, abusive to some suspects. So we have enough problems with police brutality that I wouldn't want to leave him on the force doing those things. And finally somebody understood that.
You wanted him off the force so that it wouldn't seem like you thought it was like okay for a cop to beat suspects?
Well, I didn't want it to seem that way.
Right.
And number two, I still was trying to be somewhat true to the theme song and to the spirit of the original Shaft.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a cop. He works kind of outside the law. He skirts law and lawlessness in a very interesting kind of way. He always did. And he was more of an anti-hero who kind of didn't compromise and did things his own way and wasn't intimidated or pushed around by anyone. And you can't do that if you're a police officer. You got to take orders from somebody.
Now, as you probably know, you have enormous screen presence. And this may sound like a really stupid question, but is that something that just kind of exists or something that you are aware of and can work with and can turn on and off?
I guess it's just something that kind of exists in me. I guess through my theater training, I've learned how to take dominant positions and submissive positions when that's necessary, through body language or through just positioning of oneself inside the framework of a scene. And I kind of do it thoughtlessly now. If I'm the dominant person, I just take a dominant position and try and make myself as large as I possibly can. And when it's time for me not to be there and just kind of be in the background or just be around, I try and find a way to make myself almost invisible. It's not something that I think about.
Can you talk about that dominant position a little bit? How do you find that position?
You find a way to either be taller than or in the foreground of, or your body position is in a stronger position than the person that you're talking to or reacting to, by having, you know, straighter shoulders, a more upright position. You find a way to put yourself in a position that makes that other person sit or look up or face away from you, so that you are the dominant person. It's almost called upstaging, as they used to call it when you were doing theater. I said, you're upstaging that person. Well, it's a purposeful upstaging.
I love the way you speak and the way you do your lines in film. So I thought I would play one of your great monologues. And this is a scene from Pulp Fiction, where you and John Travolta played hitmen. And toward the end of the movie, toward the very end, you have a religious awakening because you believe that only the intervention of God could explain why you weren't killed in the shootout. Mm-hmm. So at the very end, you're at a diner with John Travolta when two crazy people pull out their guns and demand that everyone hand over their money. So you get the gun away from the guy and quote the passage from the Bible to him that you used to quote before killing somebody. Mm-hmm. So let's play that scene. This is Samuel L. Jackson.
You read the Bible, Ringo?
Not regularly, no.
Well, there's this passage I got memorized. Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the iniquities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness. For he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know I am the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon you. I've been saying that shit for years. And if you heard it, that meant your ass. I never gave much thought to what it meant. I just thought it was some cold-blooded shit to say to a mother before I popped a cap in his ass. But I saw some shit this morning made me think twice. See, now I'm thinking, maybe it means you're the evil man and I'm the righteous man. And Mr. 9mm here, he's the shepherd protecting my righteous ass in the valley of darkness. Or it could mean you're the righteous man and I'm the shepherd. And it's the world that's evil and selfish. Now, I'd like that. But that ain't the truth. The truth is, you're the weak. And I'm the tyranny of evil men. But I'm trying, Ringo. I'm trying real hard to be the shepherd.
That is such a great scene. And you have such an interesting contrast there between the Bible reading and then all the slangy stuff that you're saying. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about your line readings there of the Bible and of the more colloquial lines as well? I don't know if you actually kind of, you know, decide in advance where you're going to breathe and which words you're going to emphasize, or whether you just kind of do it in a more improvisational way.
Well, I do a lot of things. I break down scripts into beats, dramatic beats, in the context of a scene. What one particular thing is trying to do, what the next thing is trying to do, and what explains what and why. Which leads me to things that have to be together that don't have a breath and things that can be breathed between. It's not a science, but it's just good old-fashioned theater training where you learn to understand the purpose of each particular scene and what a sentence does in terms of moving that scene along or defining what came before it or what's going to come after it. And doing something textual, like a Bible verse, you want to do it as straight as you possibly can to make sure that the quotation marks are there. And after that, the explanation of what it may mean in this way or it may mean in that way until you get to the definitive moment of what it really means is, which is the most serious element of it, you know. But the truth is, you know, you're the weak and I'm the tyranny of evil men. Which is like the, oh my God, is he going to kill him? You have to have that suspense right there in that moment. And then, you know, he shows that he's kind of been redeemed by letting him go. But you just build tension by doing those things. It's kind of hard to explain, even in an, I guess, I was actually talking to somebody yesterday who told me they'd taken a film class last year, and all they studied was Pulp Fiction. And for the last 2 weeks, they tried to break down the diner scene. I don't know how you could dissect that movie in one particular way, because it's just impossible to do.
Well, one of the things you do so effectively is use pauses.
Well, yeah. Quentin's one of the few guys on screen that allows you to do stuff like that, because I was actually passing by Jackie Brown the other day, and...
Passing by a screening of Jackie Brown?
Between,
Passing by a screening of Jackie Brown?
No, I was passing by it on television. I was channel surfing.
Okay.
And Jackie Brown was on television. And I was at the scene in the van with De Niro when we discovered the money has been gone and I see there's a number of books in there. And I stopped to think about what happened. When we were doing that scene, I would look in the bag, think for a second, and then say, it's Jackie Brown. But Quentin would say, no, take your time. And I do it again. I count to like five, and he'd say, no. I mean, you know, go through the whole thing and think about, you know, how these books got here, what was going on in that place, and realize it's Jackie Brown. Take as much time as you want, which consequently led me to that almost, you know, 20-second pause in that film that he left in it. And I just think that's amazing that, you know, he trusts the fact that an audience is going to stay with you and start going through the process with you that long. Because a lot of times, people don't want dead air in a film like that, especially a thought process. They want to, you know, feed the audience the idea, feed the audience the answer really quick before they get, you know, before they lose their concentration. But Quentin trusts audiences like I do.
My guest is Samuel Jackson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Samuel Jackson. Let's hear a clip from his film, The Negotiator. Jackson played a cop who's a hostage negotiator. After finding out he's been framed by cops, he takes cops and civilians hostage and insists on speaking to the only hostage negotiator he can trust, Chris Sabian, played by Kevin Spacey. Here's their first meeting.
All right, now you want to tell me what I'm doing up here?
I wanted to tell you face to face I'm not crazy. I'm just doing this to prove my innocence.
I believe you, Danny. Anything I can do to help you get out of here, you know, I...
Don't patronize me, man. I know you don't think I'm innocent, so don't tell me I want to do everything I can to help you get out of here. Don't talk to me like I'm some second-rate HT.
All right, you're right. I'm sorry. My mistake.
Yeah, you are sorry. Get out of here. Lock the door.
No, wait,
call
Danny,
me when you want
Danny,
to talk.
Danny, I'm ready to talk. You're right. You're right. I don't know if you're innocent or not. You could have done everything they say you've done. You could have killed that cop. I don't know, and I don't care. There are ways to prove your innocence. This is hardly one of them. And now you got hostages. So let me tell you this. You hurt one of them, you're going to burn up whatever currency you've got to deal with me. They're all I care about. You leaving here walking is a distant second. Now, do I make myself clear?
Good. Now we're getting somewhere.
Now, you've made two recent cop movies that I want to ask you about, The Negotiator and, of course, Shaft.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if making those movies changed your attitude at all in one way or another about the police. Now, in both of those movies, there are good cops and bad cops.
Mm-hmm. I guess Doing the Negotiator had a more profound effect on me in terms of my understanding of what they do and my relationship to them in terms of my life. I actually talked to some hostage negotiators and spent some time with them, you know, one day playing golf. And I know that they have a difficult job, and they are, you know, professional liars. Some of them, I guess, have to be pretty good actors because they have to make up things and say things that sound like truth, that have the ring of truth to a hostage while they're talking to them. And they put themselves in some very interesting and dangerous positions to extricate the hostages or some victims, or to make sure that there's no loss of life while they're doing the things that they do. I gained an enormous amount of respect for them.
Now that you're a movie star, you have to use a gun a lot in your films. You were very briefly a security guard when you were a lot younger. I'm wondering two things. One, did you have a gun? And
no.
Two, were you in any real-life action scenes, and were you able to use the kind of bravado that you can use in movies? Did you ever try that in real life?
Well, I didn't have a gun when I was a security guard. I just had a nightstick, which I really didn't want either because I didn't want to pose a threat to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I was out there, as I told them, I was a reporter. If I saw something happening, I would call them on a walkie-talkie and tell them it was happening, or probably would wait until it was over and then tell them what had happened, because I didn't want to walk up on anybody doing anything. It was just a security job. I don't try and be the characters that I am on screen in real life, because I'm not that person. Yeah, I will defend my house and my family and my friends in specific kinds of ways, and I've been in confrontations with people because of that. But I don't walk around looking for trouble, or I will walk away from trouble before I'll stand up and let something escalate to that point the way it does in movies. Life's a little bit too volatile, and people are a little too crazy out here now.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I used to wonder why Bruce and Sylvester and guys like that had bodyguards. But they have bodyguards because people watch them in movies being tough guys, and sometimes a drunk or some guy somewhere out of his mind wants to find out if they really are John McClane or if they're Rocky, and they want to test themselves in that specific way. So you have somebody else to defuse that situation. Hopefully I won't have to be bothered with any of that.
Now, something happened to you in real life that a stuntman might have done if it was a movie. This happened in 1988. You were standing on, I guess you were entering a train in New York City. And
I was getting off, actually.
You're getting off, and your leg got caught in the closing door?
Yeah, my ankle was, the door closed on my ankle and the train took off, yes.
So you were dragged across the platform?
The length of the platform. Yeah, almost to, I was in the middle car of the last, I was in the middle door of the last car and was dragged to within a car length and a half of the tunnel, yeah.
What went through your mind as you were getting
It's going to be a very sad Christmas. It happened on December, somewhere around December 18th, and I couldn't find anything to hold on to. I was actually trying to figure out a way to get out of it. And there were people in the train trying to pull my shoe off. There were people pulling on the door, people pushing on my foot. I was trying to find some way to figure out how I could grab hold of something on the train and get as close to the train as I possibly could as the wall approached swiftly. And then, you know, it was kind of like, okay, this is it. I'm not going to make it. And I just kind of started thinking about how sad it was going to be, or, you know, who was going to call my house and tell them what had happened or whatever. And my life never flashed before my eyes, so I guess I should have known I wasn't going to die, as people always tell you.
Oh, your life flashes before your eyes. Well,
none of that happened. So, but I was actually thinking of ways to survive.
What did you think you could do?
I was trying to figure out what I could grab hold to on the side of that train that would put me close enough to that train that I might be able to get past the wall. Or if I could just get my foot out of that door and, you know, maybe when, you know, I get to the end and I hit the wall the first time, my foot will come loose and I'll just fall down on the track or something. Maybe I won't just get dragged along to the next stop. I was hoping against hope, I guess.
So the train stopped in the nick of time.
Yeah, someone pulled the emergency cord.
And you won a lawsuit in 1996. You won about $500,000.
Yeah.
Were you hurt?
Yeah, I had to have my right knee surgically repaired. I mean, it tore all the ligaments in my right knee. Had a complete ACL tear, partial tear of the meniscus, all kinds of cartilage damage. So they had to do a lot of work to fix my knee. And I was on crutches for 10 months and went to rehab for like a year and a half.
Wow. Now, is there anything that you remember from that experience that you've been able to draw on in a movie? Like what real terror is, what real fear is that you are about to die?
Well, no, I don't give that much thought. Because I never felt terrorized, actually. It was a very calming kind of slow motion kind of thing. It's almost like people describing car accidents where everything kind of goes very slowly until, you know, it's over and then boom, everything comes back to real life. So I never had that element of terror. I've had, you know, some fearful moments in my life, you know, being in a car or, being on a plane, I guess, maybe when a plane drops enormously while you're riding, hits an air pocket, or being disturbed in a storm like that. But I don't terrorize very easily.
Samuel Jackson is starring in the new movie Shaft. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Samuel L. Jackson. He's starring in the new movie Shaft. Let's hear a clip from an earlier film, the comedy Amos and Andrew. Jackson played Andrew Sterling, a successful writer. Nicolas Cage played a thief who, for reasons too complicated to explain here, meets up with the writer and has him tied to a chair.
You tried to kill me.
Why would I want to kill you?
Because I'm a thorn in the side of the white man. I'm the voice of my people, a loud, angry voice that's not afraid to speak the truth about white America.
What's your name?
Andrew Sterling.
Mr. Sterling, apart from being a thorn in the side of the white man, you got a regular job?
I hold a PhD in cultural anthropology. I teach, I lecture, I produce and direct. I'm also the author of a Broadway play, now a motion picture.
What's it called?
Yo, brother, where art thou?
Yo, brother, where art thou? Never heard of it.
Well, maybe you've heard of the Pulitzer Prize.
You won that?
I did.
How much you win?
Who sent you here?
Want to hear more about your life? You were born in 1949 in Washington, D.C. Your parents divorced when you were how old?
Geez, I don't know. Maybe some months, maybe less than a year old.
Oh, okay. And then you went to live with your grandparents in Chattanooga, where your mother eventually joined you. What was it like moving from the North to the South, or were you too young to notice the difference?
I never even noticed. I was already there when I woke up and realized I was in the South. You know,
right.
I was an infant, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Were your parents, grandparents or your mother strict with you?
Yeah, everybody was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a lot of restrictions. I had to be at home at a certain time. I had to make certain grades. I had to treat people with respect. I was expected to achieve certain things, and I was a lot more afraid of, you know, them than I was of the peer pressure. So I kind of did what they wanted me to do and not what everybody else wanted me to do.
When you say you were afraid of your grandparents and your mother, was that fear of their disapproval, or was there a more physical kind of punishment?
All of that. I didn't want to embarrass or disappoint them. Mm-hmm. And I actually grew up in the age of corporal punishment. Mm-hmm. You know? there's something about getting, you know, hit and whipped with switches or whatever that kind of makes, you know, pain a motivator, especially when you're small. The interesting thing about that is people always say, you know, corporal punishment is bad or it's not good or whatever. For every spanking I got, there was a hug that came along with it that explained to me, you know, how much they loved me and they were sorry they had to do that. But sometimes discipline comes in that form. By the time I reached the age where I was bigger than all of them and they just didn't hit me because they didn't want to, you know, they couldn't make me cry anymore. Punishment was bizarre. I would much rather have been whipped and gotten it over with than go through some of those punishment phases, you know, where you can't go here, you can't use a phone for a month, you can't, you know, when you're restricted. It's a lot easier to just do it and get it over with.
No, I think I've made it clear that I love the way you speak. Did your family ever like try to correct your enunciation, or did you ever have a teacher who gave you a sense of diction, or is that something that you just had, or maybe you got it in the theater? Maybe you were just that way.
My aunt was a school teacher. Mm-hmm. She taught fourth grade, basically English and performing arts. So when I was very small, a lot of things were ingrained into me, especially, you know, grammatic things. Learning how to conjugate. Come on, we all listen to television. We listen to people talk, and we kind of go, oh, my God. I know I do. Maybe we all don't, but I do sometimes. Or, you know, when people say, well, that's what he should have did. And you go, no. That's very simple. It's very simple. So I was taught at a very early age how to speak, how to conjugate. And I guess learning to diagram sentences in that particular era was a great way of teaching people grammar. I don't even know if they still do it. I mean, my daughter couldn't do it when I was asking her about, you know, sentence structure. She's like, what are you talking about? So I don't know if it's even still taught. But, yeah, English was a very huge part of my school training.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you know your father?
We met.
What was he like?
When I met him, to talk to him, I guess, my daughter was maybe 6 months, 7 months old, and I went to Kansas City. I was actually on the road doing a play, and we were doing the play in Wichita, and he was in Kansas City at his mother's house, my grandmother, who had always kept up with me. She sent me Christmas cards, birthday cards. She sent me graduation gifts. You know, every year, that was something from her. And I went to see her because I never met her. And I took my daughter with me, and he was there. And it just so happened he had a daughter that was younger than my daughter, but some like 16, 17-year-old kid, which, you know, was kind of disgusting to me at the time. And we talked about that, and we had some discussions. And at one point, he said something to me, and I think I responded, and he said, you can't talk to me that way. I'm your father. And I went, wait a minute, we're just two guys talking. So we can't go to this father-son space.
it was
pretty interesting.
Did you think that he hadn't earned the right to call himself your father?
Well, not really. Right? I mean, you know, having a kid or supplying the sperm to fertilize an egg and not being around to offer support or guidance doesn't give you the right to say, I'm your father. You know, you could say, you know, I'm the guy who made you, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When you were growing up in Tennessee, did you see movies in segregated theaters?
Yeah. We had two theaters, the Liberty and the Grand, that were maybe a block from each other where we went to the movies. We weren't allowed to go downtown to the theater, so I didn't even bother. I just always was going to my theaters. It was fine.
Were there movies you couldn't see because they didn't come to the black theaters?
No. There were movies that were edited in specific ways for the whole South. I mean, they didn't just not show them in the black community. They didn't show them that way in the white communities either. What is that? Drums of the South with Sidney Poitier and Rhonda Fleming when he was this slave who goes to the North and comes back as a Union officer. That was a point in that movie where he slaps her because she's, like, passing for white. And that was a point in the movie where he slaps her. They didn't show that at the white theater, and they definitely didn't show it at the black theater because they just weren't going to show black people hitting white people in the movies.
My guest is Samuel L. Jackson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Samuel L. Jackson, and he's now starring in Shaft. The last time you were on the show, you talked about how you were a stand-in for Bill Cosby on The Cosby Show.
Yeah, I just ran into him not long ago.
Did you? Really? So he must be pleased at what a big star you've become.
Well, he actually told me he was having a hard time finding a really good stand-in for him and asked me if I'd come back.
Yeah. I'm sure you said, on my way. Do you treat your stand-ins any differently, knowing what it was like to be one yourself?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I actually know all my stand-ins in a way, or we have conversations, or I stand around and talk to them. I ask them if they understand the things that I've done so that they can do them while I'm not there. And I have a pretty good relationship with them. I treat them like they're, you know, actors on the job doing their jobs or trying to learn to do the things that I do or, use the job the way I did, studying camera technique, some acting technique, doing all I could to do exactly what he did so that everybody else can do their job easier. But also gives you a chance to grow in a certain kind of way as an actor. And sometimes, you know, people are paying attention. You'll end up with another job with that.
Now, you were an understudy for Charles Dutton in The Piano Lesson, mm-hmm. the August Wilson play. And you've said, you know, to the press that you really were so frustrated being the understudy, waiting in the wings. When I think you had started doing the role, you were told you could play it until Dutton could get to I guess he had another job.
Well, I did originate the role at Yale. I actually did
it. Oh, I see. You did it at Yale, and then he did it in New York?
Well, he did it on the road and on Broadway because the play was written for him, actually.
I see.
The only reason I actually did it at Yale was because he was off doing Crocodile Dundee 2.
Oh, right. So you've said that during that time you developed a pretty heavy cocaine habit.
Well, it's frustrating knowing that you've done something that was raved about critically, you had to listen to every night backstage, and not just saying to yourself, I would have done that differently, but hearing the audience response to it, because that's what theater is. It's that live give and take, and knowing that you used to be out there doing that and the audience was responding to you. And then out of that, the disappointment, frustration of saying, oh my God, he got a Tony nomination now. Oh no, oh my God, the play's won the, you know, Pulitzer Prize, and I wasn't out there doing it. You know, somebody else was doing it. And, you know, the job opportunities coming where he's off going to do Aliens now, or Alien 2 or 3, whichever one he did. And you say to yourself, God, maybe if I had been on stage, I would have gotten that job. So the mounting frustrations of knowing how well you did something and not doing it and seeing someone else reap all the benefits of doing it kind of combined to make me a bit crazier than I probably normally would have been.
How'd you learn to cover it up?
I wasn't covering it up. I just, you know, I actually think that because people saw me in that state for so long, they just assumed that was my state. I never thought I was covering anything up.
Did they know?
Tried to.
Did they know that you were using, or did they just assume that's how you were?
They just assumed that's how I was. I mean, that's how people saw me every day. So it was nothing unusual. I guess if, you know, they caught me first thing in the morning when I was sober before I left home, that might have been unusual to them.
So how'd you get off of it?
You know, rehab the same way. You know, I did my 28 days. I figured that if I tried this other way for, you know, 28 years and it hadn't worked, why not give this a try and see what happens? And the results say I'd done something right. It's easy for me to understand who I am, or to know what the message was people were trying to get to me when I got to rehab about me, and understanding my personality. I mean, all the men in my family basically have died from alcoholism or some form of it. And that means that, yeah, it is a family disease, and I could possibly have that, and I probably did, because, like all of them, if I bought a six-pack of beer, I drank six beers. I didn't drink one and put the other five up. I drank all six of them. I never, you know, saved anything for the next day. That's my personality. I also know that knowing that, and knowing that it is a disease that's there, I won't be well from it just because I don't do it, so I don't think there's a day coming where I can say, I think I'll have a beer, because I never could have a beer, or I never could have a joint, you know. So that's just not my personality. And every day I have to remind myself of that, and that's what I do.
Now,
I'm not trying to be well.
Do you think that obsessive quality, you know, of like you have one, then you have six, also has a positive side through your acting? I mean, are you obsessive about learning parts and, you know, learning them and doing the line readings just the way you want to do them?
Yeah, I'm as aggressive about my job and golf as I was about, you know, getting high and having the kind of fun that I used to have. I'm having a lot more fun now because I can remember what fun I had. And I can talk to people about it. And nobody's calling me to say, do you really feel that way about me? What are you talking about? So it's better. When I used to wonder how I would live without that, it was mind-boggling to me. Will I be as much fun? Will I be able to laugh? Will I even be able to act? All those questions got answered. And I'm enjoying my life a lot more. And the interesting thing for me is I was a fine actor. I was a good actor. And I could do things when I was using. But when I stopped using, I became a much better actor and a lot more successful actor. I don't think that if I went back to using, I would be as successful, or everything I have now would find a way to go away, because that's not what God intended for me or what my public wants from me in terms of what I give them when they come to see me work.
My guest is Samuel Jackson. Let's listen to a clip from the 1991 film Jungle Fever, in which Jackson played a crack addict named Gator. He's pleading for money from his family, money they don't want to give him because they know how he'll use it. Here he is trying to wear them down.
Oh, look at here. I'm a little light,
What, you didn't get your check from Soul Train yet?
Yo, Don lost my address. Come on, hit me. Get some cash in my hand.
Now, you had a special award at the Cannes Film Festival for your performance in Jungle Fever, in which you played a crack addict. Having been a cocaine user, were there things that you felt you really understood firsthand about, you know, someone who uses drugs that you could use in that role?
Oh, definitely. I understood that it was easy to play the effects of being high and just do that on the surface of what's going on with Gator. But I also knew that the family dynamic and how people ruin their relationships with people in their drug use was the important element of doing that particular role, of alienating everybody around him to the point where when he dies, everybody kind of understands it and knows what his father was going through and how he just collapsed every bridge that he had to humanity by doing that, because we all did it.
Were you close to doing that, or just burning a lot of bridges?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I had used up, you know, everybody's friendship when I said, you know, oh, man, I broke so-and-so-and-so, and I need some money to do this. People knew that, okay, he's going to buy some drugs with that. Or I had alienated everybody in my house, you know, was scared to talk to me. The few friends that I knew, or the few friends I used with, we were all kind of looking at each other strange, too, because we were using each other up. So it's a... It was really important to me to show that this guy was personable. He used his connections to people to use them, to abuse those friendships, so that in the end he was alone. So by the time he died, his death meant something to the people around him. It was not so much a tragedy as a relief. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people that I met or ran into after seeing that film, you know, described Gator as their brother, their husband, their sons, somebody close to them, any family member, because they'd all been abused that way.
You're kind of a sex symbol now.
No kidding.
And I'm wondering if, like, you see your own body in a different way, you know, now that so many people, like, would desire you. Do you know what I mean? Now that there's so many people who are, you know, imagining you. I don't have to keep going, do I?
yeah. Tell me.
So, do you see yourself differently?
No. I see myself as the same guy I always was.
Did you ever sit home alone and bored for a few minutes thinking, well, I may be bored now, but I know a lot of people are probably really thinking about me?
No. But, you know, to be honest, I actually do some days walk the street and I wonder how many people are going to recognize me today. I walk through through crowds of people sometimes to see who will notice that I walk through that crowd. I do that. I mean, I'm not, you know, crazy enough to think that people aren't going to notice me, or I'm not so confident or bored by the attention or bothered by the attention sometimes that I try to avoid it. Sometimes I'm like, you know, just walking around, just trying to see what will happen if somebody sees me.
One more question. Now, in Shaft, you get to wear this incredibly cool-looking Armani black coat, mm-hmm. whereas Richard Roundtree is in his old turtleneck with that brown leather jacket that he had in the original Shaft.
I think that's a different jacket.
It's a different jacket?
Yeah.
Looks like the same one. It certainly looks like the same turtleneck. Do you get to keep your Armani coat?
Yeah.
And do you wear that in the street when you're walking down to see if people are going to notice you?
Not yet. Since I've done that film, I haven't had the clothes. And they're in California, and I've been in Canada doing another film, and now I'm in Philly doing another film. So the seasons haven't come around yet where I can wear it, but I will next year. But I also understand, though, that they've sold out of that coat already.
Right.
And they have a huge back order for it.
Samuel L. Jackson, he's now starring in the new movie Shaft. Coming up, our book critic recommends a newly republished memoir. This is Fresh Air.